you're going on multiple combat deployments. You're finding yourself now in a leadership position at some point during your experience.
Yep.
You have a rock at home.
Yes.
Which I imagine that provided you with a lot of strength. Family is now manifesting itself at home. And you're trying to cultivate, I imagine, some of the same principles of structure and family with the people you're working with on your deployments.
Yeah.
Because it's just you guys out there. I mean, people don't understand that aspect. You're with your team and you're with them.
That's your little family.
You smell their farts.
Yeah, everything.
And you patch people up. You get to hear their moaning after they find out their significant other cheating on them. You're the psychologist. You're everything, basically, to some of these people that you're out there with. The war is progressing. Politics are changing back home. You're going through the transfer of a war setting during the Bush administration into
the Obama
administration. What does that feel like on your end as a war fighter?
I think, around 2009, we were in Afghanistan, and that's when they came out with, Obama was obviously in office. They came out with the coin strategy, and that was pretty much remain in place in Afghanistan. And now we are going to go out to these village stability operations, which you're going to go live in a village with the, Afghans and become friends with them and help them rebuild, right?
What do they need?
Yeah.
What can we help you out with?
Hey, we know we've just spent the past 4 years coming in and fucking everything up. Now we want you to trust us and be friends with us. And I remember when that was explained to us, like, hey, this is the new way forward. That's when I knew. I was like, we're not trying to win. There's no strategy here to win. This is a remain in place. And I wasn't obviously in a leadership role at that time, but I'm smart enough to know, like, this strategy does not seem right. It was, and everybody else was in the same mindset.
It was enough of a deviation from a logical course of action that you stated at the beginning of this, that you didn't care about the politics, where they were fighting war, and everything made sense in that realm. But this shit doesn't make sense.
Yep, and that's when, politics started creeping in, where you start paying attention, and you're like, wait a minute. And then they... Rules were, hey, you guys can't go out at night anymore. You're not allowed to go hit these targets at night because it's unfair to...
You're not allowed to do operations where you have the full advantages of your technology.
Yes, because it's unfair to the Taliban. Those were the words that were said to us. And that's when you're like, okay. And here's the thing. As team guys, we're like, we're going to figure out a way around it. But at the same time... These rules should not be implemented on us. Like, why is this happening? And you don't have time to really think about it, right? You're like, okay,
you just adapt.
How can we adapt and keep doing our job? And that was around 2009, and then we kept deploying. I went back to Afghanistan in 11 or 12, I forget. And that's when I really saw the big shift. I was like 2 days in country and shot two dudes that had shot an RPG at a AC-130, which was stupid. They were never going to, but I was like, well, that's...
Choices were made.
Yeah. And I got right away reprimanded and, investigated for 2 weeks.
Somebody fires an RPG at a personnel carrier that has people that are on your side.
Yeah.
And you shoot back at them as a response.
Yeah.
And they end up not being alive.
Yes.
And you're in a war and you're in Afghanistan. What is wrong? What was wrong with that?
I couldn't figure it out at the time either. I was like, why? Because I'm like, this is new. I think just the narrative was starting to shift. Like, hey, we're not here to kill these people anymore. we're here to make sure that Afghanistan can sustain itself, and you need to train, worry about training the Afghans up to, so they can do the job, right?
So you're there trying to instruct your replacements to stabilize this area.
Yeah, which was, if anybody that was on the ground is like, that's not going to happen. Like, that's impossible.
What are the sentiments of the people there with the prime minister leader that the U.S. had basically installed there? Like, what are you feeling as far as the people there, as far as this quasi-government now in place and the military that you're basically trying to build up?
I think it was a mix. You'd have some individuals that were, like, dedicated, and, you know, and they were good dudes. These Afghans, they were, like, actually loved their country. More of the interpreters than anything. And then, but the majority of them, dude, they don't give a shit. Yeah. They're like, whoever is in power will do whatever you want. So it was like, oh, the Americans are doing this? Cool, we're cool with that. And then if the Taliban comes, nope, now we're with them. Yeah. And I don't blame them for it. They're in a survival mode. They're like, and I think a lot of them are like, just get out. Just leave our country. Leave us alone, right? And I don't blame them for that either.
Now things are shifting. Now you're in the wrong there by doing that.
Yeah, I mean, it was fine. It ended up being like, hey, you did the right thing. But it was the process of like the questions that were asked of me and just the angles of the questions. And I was like, are you trying to screw me over or what is going on?
You're being basically prosecuted.
Yeah,
you have to reprove your actions.
You're guilty until you prove yourself innocent.
Which is that a standard thing in the military?
That's standard in the military. And I learned that. Obviously, we'll get into it. But that was that shift happened. And then we were being tasked with going out, we had the commando mission. So we were taking 200 Afghans out, and there's only four or five of us, and we're hitting targets, which to me, I was like, I remember thinking multiple times going on operations. I was like, dude, if I die doing this, like what is going to be said? Like, what are we doing? You know? Still you're doing it anyways. And you know, your brothers are out there doing it with you.
What support do you have action wise? Like you had this investigation. What support do you have while you're going through this process? Who's with you while you're going through explaining your actions?
Nobody.
It's you. It's like, you. Hey, just sit there
and answer these questions and we'll see what happens. Even my leadership was sort of like, I don't know. Like everybody agreed what I did was right.
Yeah.
They were like, yeah, dude.
But everybody's basically just standing in the room
like,
quiet.
Well, we'll see what happens, you know? Yeah. And so that was definitely an awkward thing to go through, and that's when even then though I was like, okay, this is just the command that I'm working with, this is how they are.
But you start noticing a pattern throughout.
For sure.
Are you talking to other people that are going through the same process as you are, like, hey, this just happened and now I'm being pulled in?
Yeah,
what I do, Eddie? And like, what do I say? Is this like a common thing now happening with a lot of
people? Yeah, and people are just like, hey, you know, I mean, I think I wasn't, you know, obviously there was a lot of other people that were going through the same thing, and there were certain units that already had lawyers going out with them, and they're like, you write this when they ask you, you're fine, right? We didn't have that, but, I mean, that's what had to happen. I mean, units were taking lawyers with them to protect the guys from doing their job.
This is Obama administration influence, things are changing, and
yep.
We're not the bad guys. We need to paint ourselves as the goodest of good, I guess.
Yeah, winning the hearts and minds, you know, and it's like that's not what we're designed for. There are, you know, the Green Berets, yes, that's what they're trained to. SEALs, no. Like, we're here to either capture or kill and get the job done, in and out. We took on the job of the Green Berets as well. I mean, and the Green Berets also took on our job. It just became everything melded into each other.
Your multiple deployments, what are the new generations of people coming in like? Like the new guys that are coming in off training and now deploying with you?
Yeah.
Is there a change there with some of these
guys? Yeah. I noticed it. It was just different, like a different mentality.
Not a generational change, because I don't think it's about generations. I mean, if you're going into that line of work and you're driven, motherfucker, I mean, there's a type.
Yeah.
But something changed as far as the process, maybe? Is that what happened? Or?
Well, I'll tell you this. I was like I said before, I was a first phase instructor in 2012. I think I get my time, maybe 2010 and 11. And during that time, the Obama administration wanted to create 500 more SEALs.
Expedite.
Yes, because, you know, the Bin Laden thing had happened. All of that, so we were now America's heroes, and so they wanted to make more of us so we could expand ourselves all over the globe. And so what was happening at BUDS was they were increasing the class sizes and then trying to lower the standards here and there to create more SEALs. And you cannot have quantity over quality.
In what ways were they lowering standards? I mean, I understand the larger class size, you could get away with more shit, I guess, in the crowd.
Yeah. So the way I explain it is this: it doesn't. No system is perfect. So even when we went through in class before, you're always going to have the bottom 5%, right? The two or three guys that squeaked by. Well, now that if you increase the sizes, now you're having 5 to 7 guys squeak by, which. To other people, be like, oh, that doesn't seem like a lot. Well, when you're running 7 classes a year, that's 35 dudes that don't belong that are getting sent to the community. We're not a very big community, so that spreads.
Yeah.
Right? And I definitely, my wife, my prophetic, when I was an instructor, she called that out too. She's like,
What would she see?
She was...
Women know, man. Women know.
She would hear me come home and bitch about, like, them trying to lower the standards and... They would, you know, try and take away times like, oh, log PT used to be 3 hours. Now it can only be 45 minutes. And like, it was like little things like that, which aren't so little, but
I mean, they add up.
They do. And so she would hear me bitch about it and she'd be like, this is not good. She's like, you know, cause she understood she was, you know, Brad and Aaron, that was her first introduction to this is what team guys are. And then now she was like starting.
Was she meeting some of the newer generations?
Yeah. And she was, you know, but she was doing her due diligence. Like she was talking to the wives that were coming in and helping them, you know, I mean, like, hey, she would have Bible studies at the house with the wives come out and just sort of like introduce them into the community that way. But, you know, we both were like, we're going to pay for this later on. Something's going to happen. And
Were you noticing just a general change? You talk about Bin Laden and the popularity and the attention being placed on the community that you're a part of, where you were supposed to be like, you know, silent professionals, and all of a sudden, are you seeing books being written?
Are you seeing
shows, people going to Hollywood? And what effects is that having on you in the field as a warfighter? Like, what's changing for you there?
Just the notoriety, and then the, you know, you're in the spotlight, which that's the last place you want to be.
Yeah,
right. No. And you know, it's just like the quiet professional it went away.
Yeah.
It seemed like it did. It was still in the community. Like there was a group of us, you know, a large group that were still quiet professionals, but you had a lot more outliers now that were either joining, and I called them tourists or stepping stone SEALs. They were joining. I'm going to do my 1 or 2 platoons, and then I'm going to go make something to myself because I'm a SEAL and I have a trident, and I'm going to go use that. You saw a lot of that.
Businesses and companies or, like, motivation guys.
Yeah.
Like, stuff like that.
Like, they weren't joining for the same reason as a lot of us were, which was, like, we're here to go fight and be with each other.
Is there division forming? The way you describe the community when you started, I mean, everybody is there with an intention, and also 9/11 happened, so all of you had something that you wanted to figure out. But now it's not that clear anymore. I mean, clarity of purpose is kind of like fading into the background a little bit.
Yeah.
And people are, as you say, squeaking through that shouldn't have been there. People are gaining that tourist trident, as you say, just going there for a few times and then leaving. And that's basically corroding the institution that you're a part of in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I felt like that's what was happening. It was being corroded. I wouldn't say like the division. I would say like the leadership was more kowtowing to these new guys than having our backs.
When you say kowtowing, I mean bowing to...
Yeah, like, hey, you need to learn how to talk to this new generation. You need to use kid gloves. This old school way's gone. I was told that. Like, I was told, you're too old school. You need to reform, and if you're going to start moving forward.
You're talking about you being in a leadership position and adapting exactly what was done and examples that you followed through your process. You were basically replicating what made you a successful warfighter and made you survive.
Yes.
And that's too hard.
Yeah, because now we're worried about feelings. And
because these guys are going to talk.
Yeah.
Is that it? Is that basically now these guys have ears on them?
They have
a channel.
They have a voice.
They have a voice.
And they have ears.
An individual voice.
From the leadership.
An individual voice in a group of people that are supposed to be all about the group.
Yes. We're talking about this like it was like this huge problem. It wasn't like massive, but it was there. It was definitely like sprinkled throughout. And most of the guys in my peer group, we're talking about it. They're like, this is an issue. Like, and we're all having to deal with this. But it was like, we all felt like the command, the leadership did not have our backs. It was, we had to walk around on eggshells just to get anything done.
Makes it really hard to do your actual job.
Exactly. Yeah. There was definitely bits and pieces of that. And then, you know, it all came to fruition. My last platoon.
You're in a leadership position in this last platoon.
Yeah.
This last deployment.
Yeah, I was the chief of the platoon. I was a tactical leader.
Describe a day of work. You're going out with a group of men and doing your job.
Yep.
Everybody's being treated the same way. Everybody's in on the same thing. We're all working. The same thing unchanged since the start of this.
Mm-hmm.
Or what's changed?
With them, I'll just give you an all-around perspective. Is, you know, I took over that platoon. None of them had been to combat. I think the oldest guy in the platoon was 10 years younger than me. And I think I had one guy that had been, I had one combat deployment. They were a good bunch of dudes. Like when we started off, they were all willing. Like I was like, and I let them know my expectations. I was like, this is what we will be training our asses off because we will be going to the best place, and the best place is where the action's happening.
Yeah.
And that's what we're fighting towards. So they were all on board with that. I think everything came to a head when we got there. We went into Mosul, Iraq. That's when ISIS had the strong, you know, it was ISIS stronghold.
It's already, this phenomenon of it starting to basically just take back territory.
Yeah.
That's where you
go back. Retake Mosul again.
Yeah. Mind fuck for you.
It was gnarly to be like, dude, what are we doing?
Yeah, this is Groundhog Day shit.
And I'll tell you, like, my mindset at the time, I knew, I was like, this is, we're literally just doing this to hand it over to another enemy, you know. But I didn't, I was like, whatever, this is the job. Let's kill as many ISIS as we can. And so we were tasked with retaking Western Mosul. And it was gnarly.
What changed with that enemy? I mean, you talk about at the start of the invasion, they throw shit at the cars, at the Humvees from bridges, and they would be kind of crafty. But then what was this type of enemy? ISIS.
They were a lot more organized.
Experienced.
They also had, I mean, the Taliban was there working for them. Al-Qaeda was working for them. All sorts of like just different terrorist organizations came to Mosul.
Basically experienced fighters from all over the place joining up. And
I mean, we had Americans there working for them that were, you know,
technology wise.
They had drone, like
they were changing. That's the the first times that you probably saw those civilian drones being used against you.
Yeah. So now it was like a true 360 environment. It was, you're looking for, I mean, that was probably the most IEDs I'd ever seen in my whole career. The amount of vehicle-borne IEDs they had was just insane. They were staged all over the city. I mean, the ISIS had years to prep this city waiting for us to come take it back, and they did. They did a hell of a job. They dug, I mean, the tunnel systems were insane, and they were just savages.
Yeah.
I mean, the ultimate savages. I mean, they didn't care. They were mowing down women and kids in front of us. I mean, we drive through neighborhoods. There was dead bodies stacked up everywhere, kids' heads on spikes. Like,
and this is something we're seeing, you know, stateside. We're seeing social media being utilized as an ISIS propaganda arm.
Yeah.
We're seeing, you know, these guys being burned alive or thrown from the top of buildings and all the, this a clear, like, if you wanted to clear enemy, like a clear bad guy,
yeah,
you could fucking make it up.
There's no question.
Maybe they're fighting for their land, their freedom. No, these guys are fucking monsters.
Pure evil. Like, that's
the enemy.
Yes. And it was, and when we got into country, Trump had just been elected a couple weeks beforehand. And that was the first directive we had had in years of, like, go and get rid of this problem.
Yeah.
Get the job done. Kill them all.
It was clear.
It was clear as day. And that's all we had. I was like, Roger that.
Yeah.
We were partnered up with an Iraqi force, the Emergency Response Division. And our job was AAA advise and assist and accompany. So we were not supposed to be on the front lines. We had to be within 800 meters of the front line. But we quickly figured out that we weren't getting the job done doing that. The Iraqis that we were partnered with were not moving through the city because we were not up there with them. So about a month in, we were like, we need to change our tactics. My OIC and myself were both in agreement that we are not a defensive unit. We are an offensive, so we need to start employing our organic weapons more. So I would start creeping up towards the front line, finding a good high ground spot, and just start laying down waste as best I could to get the Iraqis moving, and it worked. And it was a tactic that we used pretty much the whole 6 months that we were there.
Were you noticing some of the apprehension basically built into you and some of the newer generations from this administration that was before that was like, hey, but now you're back at what you had to do there.
Yeah.
So there's like, are we really supposed to be doing this?
Well, that was the issue as well, because while we were doing this, we'd have leadership come out. These were admirals and generals, and literally tell us that this isn't our fight, that it's not worth dying for, that we should not be getting involved. And then they would fly off, and then we would leave the wire and go right back into it. And to me, I was like, you were doing such a disservice to the guys in my platoon. Like,
that's a strange thing to just drop that opinion. That's an opinion. That's a weird opinion just to drop on people that, you guys don't have a choice. You're there.
We're going into it every day, and you're telling us that this is not worth dying for. And, oh, by the way, we just lost two of our buddies. So you're telling me that their deaths are worth nothing?
Yeah.
Like, to me, it was just a slap in the face. And I would tell my guys, I'm like, don't listen to that bullshit. I'm like, they have no idea what they're talking about. They're not going out there. We are. And this is the job that we're doing. But I definitely think that them coming out and saying those things, the political nature of it definitely got into some of these guys' heads. And there was some guys in my platoon that voiced their opinion, like, we don't agree with this mission. We don't agree that we should be out here. And why are we going out every day?
And what that's...
It was
abnormal, I imagine.
It was the first time I've ever heard anything like that. And being in a leadership position, that was a hard thing for me to deal with, because my immediate response is, get the fuck out then. Go leave. But you can't do that. So I'd have the sit-downs with them and sort of try to explain to them, like, you do realize that this is the mission that we're given and that this is a voluntary program. Like, you can leave at any time, but we are going to do this mission. It's not our job to tell them, like, we don't agree with this.
Yeah.
It's like, we are a hammer, and that's the nail, and we're going to do it.
The incident that led to some of this. Mm-hmm. I guess this this you being crucified. Before we started this conversation, I gave you a piece of silver with my old unit logo on there. One side says plata and the other side says plomo. I gave you silver specifically. I think it's a symbol of something, and I don't know. I think you're a stronger man than I am.
I doubt that.
There was an incident that happened out there, and people saw it, and people with opinions, you know.
Everybody's got them.
And people with a different set of eyes, I guess, or a different set of programming behind those eyes, and people that just didn't realize that they were in a place where they're fighting an enemy that's skinning and burning people alive and throwing people off the tops of roofs.
Yes.
That are, you know, I mean, the clearest of evils that I think most of us have been able to see in our current age. And you speak about this incident that they witnessed and that led to your subsequent prosecution.
Mm-hmm. So that was about midway through our deployment. We had to completely shift our operations up north and start clearing down that way because ISIS was just killing way too many of the Iraqi soldiers, and we had taken some actual wounded at that point too. So that was the first day of clearing from north to south, and we happened to hit a jackpot. There was a village that we pulled up on. It was just filled with ISIS fighters, and it couldn't have gone any more perfect. They came out. We were set up in a great position, and it was a turkey shoot for about an hour and a half, and then we let the Iraqi forces go clear through that village. They ended up, we had ended up dropping on a building that they were shooting at us from with some Hellfire missiles, and the Iraqis cleared through that building and found a individual that was barely still alive.
ISIS fighter
that they had thrown on top of their hood of their vehicle and drove him back to us. And so it was kind of a big deal because most of us had not interrogated an ISIS fighter, or, you know, we just killed them all.
Yeah.
So everybody, you know, came around when they brought that guy back, and he was 17, skinny, nothing, but he had been wounded in the leg, and you could tell he had a blast wound and his lungs were not working properly. So we ended up doing a medical intervention on him. I got out the med bag, started treating him, and he ended up dying of his wounds. And afterwards, the fighting had stopped for the day. It was around 3 or 4 in the afternoon. The Iraqis did not want to clear anymore. They were
like, we're done.
We're done. So we were tasked with staying out there for another 3 hours just to see, you know, if they were going to make any movement or not. And it got pretty boring. And so guys started messing with the body because it was laying there.
It's an anomalous thing to have somebody being brought back in that way.
Yeah.
To a place where you can, you know, you're safe there. Well, technically.
Yeah, as safe as you can be.
As safe as you can be, so you can, you know, do things abnormally that you wouldn't be able to do if you're, like, shooting the turkey shoot.
Exactly, yeah, if something was going on. So we knew, like, the day's done. And so we were messing around. We took pictures with the dude, just messing around with it. That was it. That was, like, the day was, I think we ended up, actually, before we left, fired a couple javelins, and then went back. And so when we got back...
Somebody took a digital picture of that.
Yeah, yep.
And that...
Yep, that became... So we got back, guys were having a conversation about it. They were, like, worried about the pictures that were taken. So I was like, hey, just delete them then.
Yeah.
Like, get rid of them. Not a big deal. That was it. That was, like, pretty much all that was really said about it that day. But at that point, there had already been three guys in that platoon, the ones that voiced their opinions that they didn't believe in this mission, were already creating they're poisoning the well.
They saw an opportunity in that specific incident that they can make, basically throw that gasoline on, I guess.
Exactly. So they
could prove that their opinions about this are valid, I guess.
Pretty much. Yeah. They thought that, you know, I still to this day, I just can't comprehend what their mindset is, but we continued the rest of the deployment, but there was like this underlying toxicity that was happening. And as a leader, I sensed it, but I really couldn't get a grasp on like what was going on. We had a couple more talks before the deployment ended. I brought them all in. I was like, get your issues out in the open. What is going on here? And it was all very like, no. Like, you know, a couple things were said. Like, I think we're going out too much. I think, you know, this and that. Which I was like, okay, that's not going to stop.
You think conversations had already been taking place?
Oh, yeah. And I found them. You know, they were texting each other back and forth. And I actually stumbled upon a text thread where they were
talking. They're basically snowballing this.
Yes. And so, you know, I at that point, at the end of the deployment, I knew, I was like, all right, there's definitely some dissent going on. But at that point, the deployment was over. The last month we were there, we really didn't do too much, which I was thankful for. Mosul had been cleared. And so we had about a month to sort of, I told the guys, I'm like, take this month and work on your health, work on like just decompressing. So when we go home, you'll be that much better off. But they used that month to sort of spin up all this stuff. And so I didn't find out until I got back to the States, back to the team, that they were starting to spread all these rumors about me.
Was it just rumors, or were these people basically already in conversations with?
At that point, well, to my knowledge, they were just rumors that were being told to other SEALs that were operating, and these SEALs were coming up to me.
And is this something in your past experiences? Is this something that you've experienced with other people?
No, I never had an issue like this before, I really didn't know how to handle it except to confront it. Yeah. So as soon as I heard these rumors, I pulled them all in again, and I was like, I want to squash this right now. I'm like, get everything out on the table, and I, you know, confronted them about each of the rumors I heard, that I was a thief and that I was aggressive and that I, you know, too aggressive and I was whatever, blah, blah, blah. The list went on, but I confronted each one of them and they had nothing. They were like, I was like, what did I steal? Please tell me what I stole, because I've never stolen from anybody. It's the first time I've been accused of being a thief. And they had nothing to produce. They were like, well, you owe somebody money for a haircut. And I'm like, okay. And so
it grasping just, a straw.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. And I just told them, I was like, you guys need to end this. I'm like, this is not going to go anywhere good. I get it. You guys don't like me. There was a certain group. And I was like, well, I don't like you either. And I'm like, but this is a job. And I was like, I'm going to be a professional. We're going to move on. And I will help you. I told them, I was like, I will help you out with whatever you need in your career. But as far as like friendship goes,
no,
we're not buddies, you know. And it wasn't until 7 months later, when I was pulled in,
they were probably somebody in a position saw that incident and like, this is interesting.
Yeah. Well, the problem was they kept going to the leadership with these petty complaints like, oh, he's this, he's a thief, he's too aggressive, his tactics are dangerous. Yes. And so the leadership was like, explain. Yeah. Oh, okay, explain, because this guy got the number one chief, he's got all these, you know.
Look at his career.
And the command I was working for, MARSOC at the time, they said nothing but great things. So explained to us, and they had nothing. So the command finally told them, they're like, listen, if you don't have anything legitimate, then go on about your lives, like, because this is ridiculous. That's when they came back months later, like, he committed a war crime, and he stabbed a ISIS prisoner to death. And that's when the command's like, well, all right, are you guys sure you're going to go this route? Like, this is what you want to do? And they're like, yes. And so they had to report it to NCIS, and that's where
seven months later
yes,
suddenly makes it into a conversation after all these confrontations and back and forth, and all of a sudden that.
Yeah. And that's what we joke about it. It went from, because they said I was stealing power bars and cookie butter. I was like, it went from power bars, cookie butter to war crimes.
Just stabbing an ISIS fighter.
So obviously when that happened and NCIS got involved, that's when the whole thing blew up.
And for people that don't know what NCIS is,
Naval Criminal Investigative Service. So they are the investigating body for the Marine Corps and the Navy. So if there's any incident that goes on, those are the people that are investigating, trying to figure out what happened. And they are the bottom of the barrel when it comes to investigative work or any kind of work like that. Just like these are the guys who try out for the FBI and all that and don't make it. And this is their what they can do.
They get wind of this. Are you aware that an investigation of this nature is now underway?
I was pulled in and told that I was now under investigation for LOAC, Law of Armed Conflict, and that's all that was told to me.
What support are you getting?
Nothing.
It's the
opposite. It was automatically I was
isolated,
a target, and I was at public enemy number one, isolated, shunned. I was pulled from my position as a instructor, put into an office, and was told, like, you cannot do anything.
Wait.
And here's what they do is they're like, oh, this thing will probably just blow over. Just wait here. And, like, I was given no task, no job. That was going on for 3 to 4 months. During that time, my wife and I were having deep conversations about what we were going to do. And I think I was like, all right, I'm going to get out. I'm like, this is not the community that I joined.
Were you basically feeling like they were trying to push you out?
Yeah. I felt like I was being shelved for no reason.
Yeah.
It was definitely obvious that, you can tell when it's like, oh shit, this is happening.
Yeah.
We both were like, hey, let's just get out. We bought a house in Florida, I moved my family down there, and I still had a year left, so I was going to be in San Diego, geobatch, until my time was out. Little did I know that during that time, NCIS was scoping out our house for a month, following us.
You were under surveillance.
Surveillance, and then they waited until my wife and I were out of the house one day, and they raided our house. They pulled my kids out at gunpoint, my 8-year-old, and then my 18-year-old who had just turned 18, which was their excuse of why they came in with assault rifles, pulled them out in the street in their underwear, just laid siege to my house. At that time, they had pulled me in for an interrogation at work. I refused to speak. I said I wanted my lawyer, so they left me in the interrogation room 7 hours. And then my wife got a phone call from a neighbor saying your kids are outside with guns pointed at them. So she drove home because she was at a business meeting. They started interrogating her immediately. I mean, during this siege, they told my 8-year-old son that I was a murderer, because he was like, why are you guys doing this? And they're like, your dad's a murderer. They told my wife I was a murderer. They already had a narrative. They're like, your father, your husband's a psycho. And this is what's happening. So they grabbed whatever they could from my house. At that point, I was released from the interrogation, came home. I had no idea any of this was happening until I got home. I moved my family to Florida shortly after that, came back, and that's when I went to a TBI clinic, NICO, to get checked out before I retired, and they came and arrested me. On September 11th of all days, they chose
a day that, you know, dramatic. This is a show. They're putting on this.
Yes.
They're putting on this spectacle.
Yep. And they wanted to, you know, to cause a reaction out of me,
yeah.
I don't know how I remained calm through all that. I definitely in my head, I was like, I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
But there was something in me that was like, just go through this, like, see what the heck is. In my head, I was like, this is a mistake.
You knew that you didn't do any of this shit. So you were like expecting, like, justice is going to prevail.
Yes.
All I need to do is just these people will find out.
Yep.
But that's not what you're seeing. Oh,
no, that's not what happened either. They threw me in military prison that day, and I didn't get out till 9 months later.
Was that first day in prison? What's that first, you know, what is that? What is that like?
It was like, so I threw me in solitary.
Why solitary? Why are they?
Because, so I had a buddy in prison that I made friends with after, you know, while I was there, but he said,
some of the best friends.
Yeah. Yeah. The closest dudes, that I'm to this day. But like he said, before I showed up, it was already like being told like, hey, we're bringing this psychopath SEAL. He is like insane. All these things were being told about me.
Basically implanting this narrative throughout.
Yeah. And so that's, you know, they threw me in solitary for 4 days, 3 or 4 days. And then they were like, hey, we're going to put you in general population. But you are in a pedophile prison. Like this is 85% pedophiles in here, sexual offenders. Do you have a problem with that? And I said, yes, I do have a problem with pedophiles. And they're like, well, then you're going to stay in solitary. Like you need to accept the fact of where you are and don't do anything. And so I was like, okay.
Were they instigating things with you? Were they keeping you up? Were they moving you around?
Yes.
Basically trying to, that's.
The whole time I was in there breaking. Was trying to break me. And I.
Confession is what they were after. What
they were after being able to point the finger and being like, see what he's done. So I, luckily I had two guards in there. Who thought it was BS that I was in there, and they came up to me and they were like, hey, we are being briefed weekly to make you snap. And just so you know, that's why your cell's getting tossed all the time. That's why you're getting strip searched all the time. That's why, you know, all these things are happening to you. And so thank God that they had told me that early on, because then I knew it was a game.
Who was helping you outside? Like your wife is probably.
My wife and my brother.
What are they doing?
Oh, dude, my wife, as soon as I was locked up, she sent a letter to the command or like tried to call the command like, hey, why is this happening? They would not talk to her. Then she wrote up a paper, like pretty much calling a call to the brotherhood, like, this is what's happening to my husband. No real support after putting that out. So then she took to Instagram.
Was it no support because this shit has never happened before and nobody know what exactly to do, or like
it was?
Was there any precedent for this type of thing to happen to somebody?
No.
So this is like,
this is brand new.
An anomaly just all of a sudden pops up, and then I mean, even if you ask for anybody for help, like what?
Yeah, what are they gonna do? And that's what I mean. You know, for all my friends and my peers that were in, they were startled and like, what? And I think for them, they wanted to help. I mean, they were reaching out to my wife and like, hey, what can we do? But there's only so much like they could do, because if anybody had voiced any support for me at the command, they were punished.
Yeah.
So it was, the narrative was there. It was like, he's guilty. If you are on his side or if you were on his wife's side, you're gone. And so that kind of shut everything down, that support side. But my wife took to Instagram. She has a background as a marketing and branding
person. I remember some of those posts. I remember reposting some of those posts.
Yeah.
I remember this. I mean, the news was, I mean, there was no trial. It already happened.
Yeah, it was a trial by media.
You were a war criminal. That's what it said. You were already guilty.
I was not only just a war criminal. They made up. I was running drugs. I was a drug mule from Mexico because I had come down to Mexico for my best friend's wedding. So they turned that into I was smuggling drugs.
Yeah.
They said that I was a fake Christian. They added two more murder charges on without any evidence. I mean, it was literally, they were just piling, it's throwing spaghetti at the wall and something's going to stick.
Just as you went through it, what do you think that was the purpose behind you being, what did they want to achieve with that?
I think they wanted an example made. At that time, from the from the command, the SEAL teams were already under a lot of scrutiny for drug abuse. There was all these articles coming out, and they did it to themselves. I'm like, when you put yourself as the top-notch nation's heroes, guess what? There's only one way, and it's down.
Yeah.
Like, people are going to find reasons to hate on you. And so there's all these articles coming out. And so when my allegations came across the admiral's desk, and they were just allegations, he was like, make an example out of this guy. This ends now. Like, this, everything ends now. We are going to crucify this guy.
And then everything's going to go away if we just, this is going to be it.
Yeah.
Everybody goes away.
And thinking everybody's going to follow suit.
And there was another narrative put forth after, but like, the president hears about this. And this false narrative that is out there that he somehow pardoned you is out there, which is complete. That's not what happened. That gets mentioned to you at some point in there, like the possibility of pardon.
Yeah. So it was nearing the trial. The president had already, so he got me out of prison. He put out a tweet saying, let this guy out so he can properly defend himself. He wasn't saying I was guilty or not guilty. He's like, give this guy the rights he deserves, because I had none of them in there. And while I was locked up, as soon as that happened, it became uber political, right? Like, now it was...
That was more on the news.
Yeah. Even people who had no idea about my story saw that if they hated Trump, they were like, they hated me, right? It's just the nature of it. And then nearing the trial, there was two other... there was a Green Beret and an Army guy that was already in Leavenworth, and Trump was going to pardon them. And I was thrown into that mix, like, oh, it's a possibility of a pardon.
Yeah.
And what we told my lawyer, my wife and I both were like, we don't want the pardon. We want to go to trial because we are innocent. And it was a scary thing. My lawyers were like, because I was facing life without parole. And we were like,
it is an insane gamble.
Yeah.
It's also just having the experience of people prosecuting you,
especially knowing the system is rigged, like it's corrupt. But it was a, you know, we had fought so much at that point, and it was like, we're not taking a gimme, you know.
You stayed.
Yep. So, yeah, we took that on. We went to trial. The trial was like two weeks, a little over 2.5, I think. I got found innocent of everything except for taking the picture, which we didn't deny.
Yeah, the everything on their plate basically got fucking
destroyed. Yo, it couldn't have gone any better. And that was the thing. They had,
and
up to that point, they had told so many lies that these are the guys in my platoon that they couldn't keep up with the lies they had told. And it all got exposed on the stand.
And also the attachment of Trump and his presidency and basically trying to figure out how to angle this.
Yeah.
Probably. The only intervention he had in your case was allowing you to get out of prison so you can actually try and defend yourself adequately, which is...
That's, to me, I'm like, that's the right thing. Yeah. I mean, I thank God that we had him in office at the time, because I don't think anybody else would have stuck their neck out and done that.
No.
And then he intervened two more times after my trial because the... persecution didn't stop. They were extremely pissed that I got found not guilty.
What else were they trying to do to pressure you afterwards?
So afterwards, I went back to work. Like, hey, I'm ready to go back to work. And they were like, no, you are. They banned me from all the teams. They stuck me again in this office. And then they told me that they were going to take away my retirement. Because the picture, which I was like, yes, I did that, they threw the book at me. They're like, we're going to bust you down to E1. It's like your 20 years never existed. So we were fighting that after I got out, because we were like, that's, yeah. He intervened again, and he was like, you will not be, he will be retiring with everything he has earned. Get back to work, is what he told them. When he did that, then they again retaliated and were like, well, now we're going to take you and take your trident away. And we want our pound of flesh somehow.
Somehow we're going to take something from you.
Yeah. And it just became a back and forth of these, you know, these admiral and the Trump and the president. And I was just like a football being thrown back and forth at that point. But he intervened again and was like, you will not be taking his trident. And I think that at that point they had sort of like, all right, you're get out, you know. And I ended up retiring. I was a senior chief. I retired as a chief, and then I had some awards taken. You know, I was awarded written up for the Silver Star during that deployment. They took that away. But at that point, I was like, I don't even care. Like, awards never mean anything to me, and I'm like, just let's get this over with.
You come out of this experience, I imagine bitter, angry.
Mm-hmm.
There was no structure or community around you that even knew what to do for somebody in this condition.
Nor would they even help me. Yeah. I mean, they have the Navy SEAL Foundation.
Yeah.
They were completely working against me. As a matter of fact, they were calling people that were supporting me in the teams and saying, if you support him, we're taking away the money that we've given you through our foundation. So it was literally that whole community, and when I say the community, not the guys, it was the leadership. I was the devil, and they kept portraying me as such. The SEAL Future Foundation, though, which is run by my good buddy Johnny Wilson, they helped me out tremendously. He reached out. I was able to get treatments through them. So my first year out, my wife made it mandatory. She's like, "You will not get a job. You will do nothing but get treated and fix yourself for this year," which, you know, thank goodness she did.
Well, how did that feel on your end?
I was lost. I mean, I was so lost. I didn't know what direction to go. It was just a weird feeling of being thrust. Well, it's a sudden stop and then being thrust into the spotlight like that, to where it didn't matter where I went, people knew who I was, and it was either people were for me or they hated me.
Yeah.
And it was just a very, it was just a weird situation to navigate.
Again, I attached to members of the community and hearing stories of all kinds and just, you know, seeing this, your story, and like everybody had an opinion. You know?
Yeah.
I think the first person that talked to me about your specific case was Sean.
Yeah.
And he was like, yeah, they did him dirty like this. Then he started explaining to me. He's like, oh, fuck.
Yeah, it was nasty.
The sudden stop and also the betrayal aspect of it, the bitterness of it. I mean, I would have been.
I was bitter. I was angry. You know, right when I had gotten out, that's when COVID hit.
Yeah.
Even less
of an opportunity to.
Yeah. So then it, like, the whole country shut down. But at that point, I had Bernie Carrick, who was a very good friend and advisor during that whole thing. He told me, he's like, you need to write the book about everything that happened, because that is your story and you need to get it out soon. And so I worked on the book during the pandemic.
What was that process like?
Miserable.
What about it is miserable?
It's
opening a wound back up.
Yeah, opening a wound that was open already, and now it was going against everything that I was about, which was like being the quiet professional, never writing books, doing all that. So I was dealing with that as well, and then just I had all this hatred, bitterness. I wanted revenge. I wanted to take down the people that did this to me. So I would go lock myself, not lock, but I'd go up in my closet, my house, and work on the book. And I mean, I was a ghost in my house. I would come down. No, I was depressed. I'm angry. I wore a sweatshirt and I just had a hood on all the time walking around. Yeah. Or like just completely isolated. And I was like that for a while. And it wasn't until my daughter, I walked by her room one day, and I was just like, hey, and she's like, I don't even want to be around you. And I was like, what? And she's like, I don't want to be around you. And then that hit me.
That hurt.
I went back, you know, it didn't pull me out of it. It sort of like spiraled even more. And then I had my youngest son one day. I was driving him back from practice. And he just, I mean, this kid's like 9 years old. And he looks at me and he's like, "Are you okay?"
Yeah.
And like, he's looking at me in my eyes and he's like, touches me. He's like, "Are you okay?" And I'm, you know, I'm the father. And I'm like,
that's
my son. And I'm like, yes, I lied to him. Like, yeah, I'm okay. And that's when I was like, dude, I have to fix myself. And that's when I started really trying to work on getting rid of that bitterness and hatred. And
how? I mean, I remember seeing glimpses of you, you know, showing up, I mean, exercising like a maniac.
Oh,
because I know that's part of it.
That's part of my therapy. That's always has been. But
glimpses of you speaking about Jesus. Glimpses of your book and some of that coming out, but like there's an underlying anger there. Because fire, like I could see it.
Yeah.
But moving past that, and like, so when I talk about Jesus and that spirituality aspect of it, how does that manifest and what does that do for you to try and come out of that condition, this almost shock, this septic shock of the soul that comes from a sudden stop, a betrayal, and also this this unexpected ending to that life?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll rewind back real quick. When I was in prison is when I really found Jesus. You know, I had been half-assing it my whole life and did not know I was half-assing it until I completely gave everything to him in my prison cell. I talked to him out loud, and I've said this story multiple times, and it is the most important aspect of my whole story is I felt him. Like, I felt him physically take the weight off me. There's no drug. There's nothing out there that can produce that same feeling I had in my prison cell. And I like felt I was so close to him when I was locked up.
I mean, this is as solitary as you can be. You know, you're in a box.
You have nothing.
You're in a solitary space. Hope is far.
Yeah.
The known is far away from you, and all of a sudden it's clear to hear, I guess.
Yeah. And sometimes for guys like us, it takes everything being stripped from us and being like, now do you see?
Yeah.
You know, you cannot control what's going on. And that's
when you say this voice, and like, yeah, people won't understand that. I had something happen to me where I was isolated, pretty horrible thing that happened to me. And the clarity of the presence and something that just, the closest thing I can equate it to is my mother coming mm-hmm. into a room and comforting me after some horrible shit that happened to me. When I was in my 20s, I went through some horrible shit, and violence was used, and people bled on me, and I was sent back to the military barracks that we were staying at, and instead of driving there, I drove home in the middle of the night to my mom,
mm-hmm.
and my mom, without a word, just knew. You know, she took my clothes off, put it in the washer, made me coffee, and we sat in silence from 3 in the morning to 7 and prayed.
Yeah.
And when it happened to me again, I had this horrible situation. That's what I felt, this quiet voice that just, you know.
Oh, yeah, I have you.
Yeah, I got you.
Yeah. It's that unconditional love that only a mother and Jesus can provide, you know. I mean, fathers too, but like the mother, I think, has that
it's as far, it's moments where you were far away. I mean, they talk about, you know, being aware, beware of unearned wisdom, a master of hallucinogenics would say. But when you see most people that are on warrior path or people that have gone through great loss and that find God, it's always in the desert. Even Jesus went to the desert, yeah. You know? And that's not many find themselves in that place, or not many seek a life that will put you in that place.
Yeah, it's a blessing.
And also it comes with a cost, I guess, a lot of people. You know, that's why a lot of people don't want to sign up. That's why a lot of people don't want to seek purpose. You know, that's
because it does come with a cost.
Yeah.
It's, you can't, you touch war, it's going to touch you back.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's, I'm reading a book, The Body Keeps Score. I don't know if you've heard, I mean, that's, it's not unnormal, like, to have issues or to have these things when you're done.
Yeah.
Because this is what you volunteered for, and this is what you put your body through and your mind through. And you have to accept the fact that you do have some things to work through after you get out, and it's going to take a lot of work. It's not, to me, it's harder than anything I've ever done.
Yeah.
In the military.
Yeah. This, you know? This whole aspect of things going back to normal is a lie.
Yeah.
The you'll get better is a lie.
Yep.
The
it's a daily battle.
It's a daily battle.
And that's where, you know, we were talking about treatments and stuff. You know, I went and did everything. You know, I did the psychedelics, I did the everything that was on the table. I was like, yeah, I'll go try it, right? And I will say this, there's benefit to it, but it is not an end all be all treatment. There's nothing out there that's gonna be like, oh, now I'm fine. It's, you are going to deal with the repercussions of your decisions the rest of your life, and you're gonna have to deal with the blackness that comes with that, and that's always gonna be with you. You're gonna have to deal with, you know, the pain, the misery, the loss, all these things, but that you can defeat it daily. And that's how this is what I do. You know, I talk to God every morning. I get up, read a scripture out of my Bible, talk to him for 30 minutes out loud. I ask him to please give me the strength to make it through the day. I ask him to take away the thing, like, please take my anxiety, my depression, my anger, my bitterness. Take all of it. I give it to you. I throw it at the cross, and fill me with love. Fill me with joy. Fill me with forgiveness. Help me be a better man. Help me be somebody that when people talk to me, they see you. And, you know, I fall short of that all the time. But it's something that helps me get through each day, and I have to do that on a daily basis, because I know the second I divert away from that, I'm going to go right back into the whole
cycle.
Yeah, that cycle again. And that's what I try and tell, you know, my peers that are going through the same thing. I'm like, this does not end.
Yeah.
This is with us for life, and you have to find a way to overcome that. And you have to also have to accept the fact that this is not going to end.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it's hard for some people to swallow that and be like,
yeah, for me, it's been, you know, I came out of it and that was my identity. That's all I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden that's stripping away. I did not have a strong presence in my life like your wife. So I had basically everything leave me. Like, I lost everything. And even I had to look for a new life in another country on top of all of that shit. The purpose that I lost when I lost that job, I had to basically reimagine and reinvent.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it has been like, hey, how can I make this gnarly ass experience that I just had, which did nothing realistically to change the world? And I mean, we helped some people. I did some things that were pretty positive. Some people are still alive and some people are doing great. But that all ends and that all goes into the past and it just disappears.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how can I make that experience worth it now?
Yeah.
And on my end, I started a charity and I started doing work and training people and getting involved in mental health and basically just being very public with my struggles. You know, I'm like, I did stuff, cool. But the work I'm doing on myself and the responsibility I'm taking for myself now is probably the thing I'm most proud of.
Yeah.
And that 9-year old that's running around here who is the best character witness that I could ever have.
Yes. And because that is, at the end of the day, that's all that matters.
Yeah.
That's your legacy.
Yeah.
That's how I look at it with my kids and my wife. You know, I'm like, what am I leaving behind if I sit here and I'm constantly chasing the dragon every day, you know, and trying to fulfill what I want, trying to get back to that pace of life that I'm so accustomed to. I'm going to leave all this behind by doing that. Like, they will be left. They have been left behind. And now I try and simplify my life to where my priorities are my kids and my wife, and everything else is like, okay, that's secondary. But if it does not, if what I'm doing is not affecting them in a positive way or helping them or raising them properly, then I'm not doing it. Like, that is my new mission, right? Yeah. And it wasn't like I didn't feel, you know, when I was in, I always felt like, you know, that's what that matters the most. But the reality is the job mattered the most. And now, yeah, I just try and keep it as simple as possible. And, you know, and then also, we started that foundation.
Yes.
My wife and I.
Which I wanted this. I think that's a good place to kind of conclude things. You basically, there's no other better person than you to develop a foundation that will actually have support for people that are a target of
injustice.
This injustice, persecution, politicization, this corrosion of an institution that you were directly kind of experiencing. But not only did you experience it, you beat it.
Yes.
And you didn't take the easy way out. You know, you walked willingly to your cross.
Yeah. And I'll preface it like, you know, saying me or I did, it's we. My wife was right there alongside with me. And we both, before my trial, had discussed starting this nonprofit because we had seen, when I was locked up, I had seen kids in there that didn't belong in there, that went through the same exact corrupt process I did. And now we're just thrown away. The only reason I got notoriety is because I had a trident.
Yeah.
And that's why it was made sexy headlines. But I told her, I was like, this disgusts me. And now we've seen behind this curtain and seen how the system works. We can't just walk away. Yeah. And we were both in agreement with that. So we're like, okay, we are going to start a nonprofit that we started off first. It was just for active duty military because that's all we knew at the time. We're like, okay, we're going to help active duty military. But then we expanded that into law enforcement and first responders. And so what we do is we help if they're being unjustly accused for doing their job, we step in, we provide emergency relief aid or money for their family as they're going through that time. We also raise money for their legal defense, and then we advocate for them if need be. Some people, you know, want to keep it quiet, but a lot of bigger cases we end up going, we use the same roadmap my wife and brother did to defeat the government, the media. The media is a big one, right? Because they put out half-truths and lies and make, you know, create the narrative where we have found avenues where we can actually put out the truth on platforms. And there's certain media platforms that will put the truth out. They're few and far between. We implement those. We made great connections with the very few politicians that are doing the right thing, and I will stress very few. We've had, you know, we've been running for 4 years now. We've had 100% success rate, and, you know, we've helped out more law enforcement than anybody, especially.
They're under attack a lot.
Oh, right? I
do a lot of training out there. I do show up in some police academies out there and they're empty.
Yeah. I don't,
nobody wants to be, we just lived through a cancel the police process and nobody wants to grow up to be that anymore.
It's no. Like
represents everything that people just don't want to do. And
that's a hard job already.
You're already putting yourself guilty.
Yeah, and you're going out putting your life on the line every day, and then to be also having the back of your mind, like, if I make one wrong misstep, my whole life is screwed, my career is screwed, my family is screwed. And this is what, you know, I'll add this on for our nonprofit is, you know, the one I described what we actually do and our mission statement is, yeah. But the real work that now that we've been doing this for 4 years is once these people are either found not guilty or, you know, they've not getting away, but like they're, cause we've had some found guilty. But it's, the process is so disgusting. These people are sort of forced into pleading guilty, just so they can get out of prison and go see their family again. Yeah. But that's where the real work begins. Because I think even in my case, people are like, oh my goodness, like you won, everything's awesome. It's like, you're devastated. Your whole, like you just talked about, your whole identity has just been taken away. Your whole purpose has been taken away. Your family has just gone through probably one of the most traumatic experiences. Because while you're going through that, believe it or not, the government is trying to rip your family apart too, because they're just trying to add that undue stress onto you. And so we're able to step in and talk to these families, and we don't tell them what to do. We just, through our experiences, like, hey, here are some things that helped us out, make it through this. And that does more for them, what I've seen, than anything else, is being able to get on a phone call with my wife and I and sitting there and talking to them, listening to them, their problems, listening to what they're going through, and then being able to give advice on how to solve some of these problems, and then just keeping tabs on them to making sure they're doing okay.
Which is very needed and valuable.
Yes, more than anything.
I am growing to find policing in the United States more and more familiar with my experience in Mexico.
I was actually, going to ask you if you're starting to see a lot of similarities.
I mean, I am immediately, when I say that I was a cop in Mexico, I am immediately guilty of all the horrible shit, although I did the impossible to keep myself out of shit. And as soon as that job ended, I was thrown under all of the buses and left to my whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that now more and more in the U.S.
Yeah.
And standards get lowered.
Yep.
Corruption seeps in. It's scary.
It is scary. And I mean, there's so much work to do to combat all of the things that are going on in our country, but this is the one, our piece of the pie, where we can fight back. You know, the suicide epidemic, all of that. I mean, those are all major issues. And what we do as a nonprofit is we partner up with other nonprofits that are doing good work as far as like the suicide epidemic or mental health. And we will then be like, okay, we'll help these individuals out and then send them over to that way. Be like, hey, here's where you can get treatments, and just try to get them on the right path.
That's God's work.
I hope so. You know, that's the...
A lot of people talk about Christ, but they're not very Christ-like. And I think that's, you know, the hard part. That's how, yeah, it's like you can tell the real OG ones. Oh, Jesus was a gangster.
He was.
With the... few dudes that were of questionable backgrounds and stuff like that, so I can appreciate that.
But, same.
But more than anything, I view him walking to that cross willingly, which I think is what separates a lot of men out there. Not many will walk willingly into that cross, whatever that could be for all of us.
Yeah.
I signed up. I did what I did. And regrets, I've had a few, but I think I would be worse off if I didn't make my experience worth it and help people with it. And
yeah.
I think,
and that's the truth right there. I mean, that's why I titled my book when I wrote it, The Man in the Arena, because that's what we all are. It's for those of us who've raised our hand and gone and did what we did, which not many are willing to do, you are the man in the arena and you are the one out there doing the work, and the critic doesn't count. Like, that's my favorite part of that whole thing is the critic doesn't count. Like, I don't care if you weren't in the arena with me doing the work, then I don't care what your opinion is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where can people find out more about your foundation and what you're doing now, Eddie?
So, we have, the pipehitterfoundation.org. You can go on there and you can see everybody that we are currently supporting. You can read into each one of their stories. And if you are touched by any of those stories or wanting to donate, you can donate to those individual to those people individually, or you can just donate to the organization itself. I have a website, theeddiegallagher.com. I try to keep my life simple. I teach what I know. I teach shooting tactics to civilians, DOD, law enforcement at a range down there in Florida. I also travel around every once in a while doing it. I have a company, Gallagher Holdings, that is, the premise behind that is faith, family, and country. And I named it Gallagher Holdings because that's what my family has been all about. And I couldn't think of a better name to put behind it. We have apparel through there and everything else. But then you can also see, everything that I'm doing as far as the training aspect and all that. I had a Patreon, or I do have one currently right now. I'm looking to reorganize a little bit, but we'll see where that goes.
Send some people over. I mean, you're doing a lot of great work, man. I really appreciate you coming down and shedding light on some of this, talking to somebody like you that's gone through some of these things. What is amazing to me is that you still love your country and yep. There's still hope in your heart for it.
Oh yeah. My son just joined the Marines.
He's
up there in Pendleton right now. I'm gonna go visit him here tomorrow. But yeah, I tell everybody, and I get asked all the time, like, how can you let your son or join the military after what happened to you? And I think this is also an epidemic in this country where everybody wants to just blanket statement, oh, well, a couple individuals did this, so now the whole organization sucks. And that's not it at all. I had a couple bad leaders that made some bad decisions, but the military as a whole still has the same men and women joining that were joining before for the right reasons. And I think that if we have this view of like, oh, I'm not going to let my kids join, then we are definitely going to fall as a country.
Yeah.
I think that is one of the backbones of this country is the men and women that do love this country and want to serve it and are willing to go to war or do whatever they have to do to protect it. And if we're sitting here trying to talk kids out of joining the military, then I think we're going to be in a harder spot than we think. I'm proud of my son for doing it, especially after everything he had witnessed, and it was his decision, but I couldn't be more proud of it.
When I talk about my immigrant experience, I'm new to the country. I call Houston, Texas, my home now, and I'm learning about it every day. Mm-hmm. I travel across the country, and I've been to more of the U.S. than most Americans. I think I travel constantly. People ask me, "Hey, did you enjoy the freedoms here?" And yeah. I mean, if you want to be free, go to Tijuana, right? That's a freedom. I enjoy the ability to gain responsibilities. The responsibility that the U.S. has given me as an immigrant. I'm new. I don't know anything. But somehow I have the responsibility to train members of Homeland on how to be safer when they do interdictions on some weird groups out there on the border. I have the responsibility to share some of my views on what the future of Mexico and the United States could be. I have the responsibility to talk to people like you and communicate some of the aspects of your story and some of the things that I think matter in your story to an audience that I've been able to build up over the past 8 years. What other country in the world can you do that in?
Exactly.
The U.S. has less enemies to that ability to gain that responsibility than anywhere else in the world. I'm hopeful, which is weird to say at this point in history, but I'm hopeful.
I'm hopeful
for the country.
So am I.
With that, Eddie, God bless America. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for all you do.
Thank you, brother, and God bless you.